Welcome to another episode of my podcast, Sincerely Jada, a podcast hosted by yours truly, Jada Amoy. And if this is your very first time listening, this podcast is dedicated to learning and unlearning. So thank you so much for the love and the feedback I've gotten from season two thus far. I'm glad that everyone's enjoying the season. So today we actually have a guest episode, and the guest is someone I'm super excited to have on the podcast. Her name is Aisha Jenkins. So Aisha is joining us from Washington, D.C. She is a single mother by choice. So Aisha is a mother of two, and she also has her own podcast called Start to Finish Motherhood, where she shares tips for mothers. She also shares specific advice for people who are single parents by choice and those who are considering becoming one. So Aisha, in today's episode, will be discussing her decision to pursue single motherhood. She'll also get into her experience being married young, as well as her experience being divorced young, and how that affected her choice to become a single mother, essentially. We'll also be getting into navigating the healthcare system as a young woman, specifically as a young Black woman. It can be increasingly difficult to have yourself really taken seriously by medical professionals so that you can get the appropriate advice or the appropriate care. We constantly see cases of Black women especially experiencing birth complications and experiencing all sorts of health complications due to negligence, due to not being believed. We're going to talk about tips for advocating for yourself, especially as a young adult in that medical space, and how to get the information that you might need to create informed decisions. In a nutshell, I'm really excited to have Aisha today because she's going to be giving us all sorts of beneficial advice based on her experiences so that we can ultimately feel as though we have more power and choices out there when it comes to fertility, when it comes to our overall health, and when it comes to our future decisions. So thank you, Aisha, for joining me. If you could maybe just tell us a bit more about yourself and give us a glimpse into what types of things you are passionate about and what you'd like people to know about you.
Thank you for having me. I love your podcast and I am just getting caught up on season two. So thank you. As Jada said, my name is Aisha Jenkins. I have two little kids. I have a four-year-old and an almost nine-year-old, and it is a ton of fun. I am a single parent by choice. That means that I pretty much did a sperm bank with a fertility clinic, and I had my babies on my own. About 10 years post-divorce, I got married when I was 24. I dated my college sweetheart. We ended up being misaligned in terms of how we saw parenthood occurring, when we wanted to start having kids, and what a family of more than the two of us would look like. And it's not that we didn't have conversations early on. I didn't listen. So we'll get into that a little bit more. But I took my leave at 29, which I was in my prime dating and childbearing years. So it was kind of risky and scary. And eventually the dating pool was not that great for me in terms of finding long-term potential partners. And I gave myself a timeline. I said, I'm going to have one more hot girl summer. When I was 35, 36, I started trying at that time. I had a little fibroid that I needed to get removed. And then I had my first IUI in October. That failed. I had a second one that was successful in November of 2013. And I had my first daughter full term when I was 38. And so I enjoyed it so much that I tried again. The second journey was a longer, more tumultuous journey. We'll get into that as well. But eventually, after almost 3 years of trying, I got my second daughter. And so I have a four-year-old and I have an almost nine-year-old. And I am here today to talk a little bit about the things that I wish I knew when I was young enough to make some really well-informed decisions.
Yeah, I appreciate you being here. It can be very difficult to access, you know, adequate care and adequate support from professionals sometimes. So I think having that advice as well from somebody who's been there is very valuable. You got into it a bit, but I think we can also discuss more. So when I read your article on Pop Sugar about preparing to be a single mother by choice, I really found myself drawn to the line where you had said that you knew you wanted to be a mother more than you wanted to be a wife. And I think that's so interesting because we see the two as mutually exclusive. We don't necessarily give light to or have conversations about people who may not be in relationships or may have gotten a divorce or have experienced the end of their long-term relationship, but still have the goal of being mothers. And we don't necessarily acknowledge that people who might be outside of the years that are deemed ideal childbearing years, and we kind of write them off. We assume that if you haven't had a child by, you know, let's say 35, that you no longer want children because it hasn't happened yet, that you've given up on that dream, and it could be something that you wanted regardless of whether you had the partner or not. There are people out there who are single parents, and it's not by choice. It could be a situation where there's a separation, or we often see, you know, parents who are left with the child to be the sole provider when that wasn't the agreement, whether married or not. It's really interesting to think of the fact that we might have a negative opinion or a negative viewpoint of people who are single parents by choice, assuming that they might be ultra feminist or just people who hate men or men who hate women or whatever the case may be. We just have these negative assumptions. So there has to be a lot more open-mindedness towards different ways of doing things. And I like that you really emphasize that, yes, you are a single mother, but it was by choice.
So I think I love the fact that your podcast centers on unlearning, because I have gone through almost 10 years of unlearning. You know, when I was a teenager, all you hear is keep your legs closed, marriage before carriage, and all of the things and the small boxes we tend to put women into, and in particular, Black women, the box gets smaller. And so when I entered college and met my college sweetheart, it was with the mindset of respectability politics. I am one of six girls, and most of my sisters, by the time I entered college, had already had children. They were single parents. And so I got to watch from the sidelines what some of the challenges were. And in my mind, I was just like, nope, don't want to do that. Sex is taboo, you know, and then went away to college and the world opened up. My college sweetheart was my first love and everything. And so even though I was doing certain things out of order, it was still with the mindset that I'm going to marry this man. It was intimacy before marriage. It was we lived together over summers. And then when we graduated, we eventually did move in together. And, you know, we had had all of these conversations about what things would look like within a marriage. But for me and my girlfriends at the time, it was marriage. We heard nothing else really after that. They're like, go for it, girl. When I was just like, but he said this really strange thing. And they're like, ignore it, girl. Go for it. Get the ring. And I'm just like, okay. And so there was a particular moment where I had already graduated. We were living together. And I was just like, look, it's do or die. Either we get married or I'm moving out in October. He took some time to think about it. And eventually he did propose, right? But that is kind of like giving an ultimatum. Was he ready for it? I'm not sure. He didn't do it spontaneously. So one could say he probably wasn't ready. Flags that I ignored in the hunt for the ring, the marriage, the picket fence, and everything was that he had specific views of what he wanted in a wife, what he wanted for a home life, what he wanted in order to bring children into it. By me giving him an ultimatum, it didn't necessarily allow us to naturally arrive and have the depth of conversations we needed to have. I didn't really slow down enough to say, what do you mean by that? And I mean, I did ask a few times, what do you mean by that, after we were married? But, you know, my cheerleading squad was like, do it, do it, do it. And so I did it. We got married. We were married for 5 years. But the things that we kept rubbing up against was that I was 23, 24, coming into my own as a woman. I, you know, was probably not the most mature self that I could be, but I was also entering into a career that I really fought for that I thought was exciting. I think when you don't have people around you that supports the marriage, you don't necessarily have people to turn to say, how do we process this? My ex-husband was really anti-therapy. I didn't have the tools except to say, this is what I want, and to try to listen. But whenever we hit a sticking point, there was no one to break the tie, right? So we would go to bed mad and fester and angry. And my career was taken off and his was a job, then a career. So while I am doing all of these fun things with my job and having all of these experiences, like traveling for work, I was a traveling instructor. He was sitting on the couch playing video games. There ended up being a disconnect. So when I decided, like, look, I'm ready to have kids. We were like 3 years into the marriage, and this was a conversation that could not be pushed off any longer. And he's like, you know, I want total control. I'm like, what does that mean? And he's like, total control in every form that you can think of. And so it's just like, I was mature enough at that point to say, you know, let's have a few more conversations, but I'm not going to let this go. And so eventually we could not get past it. I turned to his family. They were no help. They were like, we don't get involved in grown folks' business. I really had no other resources. And so I loved him enough to say, I love you. You deserve to have whatever marriage you want to have, however unrealistic it seemed to me. And I filed for divorce at 29. And then I just moved on with the rest of my life. And I don't necessarily think he was a bad guy. It's just for me, wanting to control something that should evolve organically is not a situation I wanted to be in and could no longer stay in. Plus, we weren't having babies. I do appreciate the fact that he did put the brakes on because, you know, at 24, I wanted to have babies.
You got into it a bit, but I think we can also discuss more your choice when it came to becoming a single mother. So how you arrived at that choice, what was kind of, going through your head at the time? Because of course, we hear those negative connotations being a single parent, especially in the context of Black women. So just kind of what you faced when that was a choice that you were looking to make.
I let go of what people see as the carrot, the icing on the cake, the marriage and the kids. And so it was really scary at 29 to be out there never having really dated before, but also still wanting to be married. But when you're an individual and you're single, you're forced to have to make these choices and navigate the dating pool for yourself. You look at it differently, especially having been married. I'm just like, as much as I want this baby, I can't have you in my life forever. Neither you. And so eventually I got to the point where I had heard about IVF, I had heard about sperm banks, and I'm just like, but I still have my foundation is very traditional. And so I was living with my stepmom at the time, who was deeply into the church. I was into the church. It was almost like I needed permission. And so I would cry to my siblings, and my siblings are like, you have everything, you know, because I did get further in my career and in my education. You have everything. Nobody's going to want you. So I cried to my stepmom one day and I was like, I want a baby. I'm afraid I'm not going to ever have the opportunity to have children. And she said, you want a baby? Go out and have a baby. So the perspective she was coming with was she was in her 60s. She found religion after divorce. So I think that there's some perspective that came with it that, you know, life is short, that marriage is not guaranteed. So if you want to have this thing that is so important to you, go out and make it happen. Try your hardest to make it happen. And I think in the single mother by choice spaces, the most regret that people say they don't want to have is never having tried if you wanted to have a biological child.
Of course, you discussed your stepmom's reaction, but as a whole, when you kind of came to this decision and explained to everybody you wanted to be a single mother by choice, what kind of assumptions or responses did you get from those around you?
To put it in context, I was in my mid-30s. I was fully established with my career. I had a house already, and my parents were deceased. My stepmom was like, yeah, girl, go get it. There were really no barriers for me taking the steps that I needed to take and having real challenging conversations, because there are people who have some really challenging conversations. And then the stakes for the conversations I did have were not huge, right? For the most part, when I told my friends and family, they were like, oh, you know, so excited for you. Go, you know, do that. But I did have interesting conversations with the male friends in my life, and in particular, my older brother. And I did not grow up with my older brother. So when I say the stakes were not as high for that conversation, it's just like, well, most of my life, you weren't there anyway. I'll listen. It wasn't going to be the thing that kept me from moving forward. And so for him, his response was pretty much, you do all this traveling. You have such a great life. You know, kids are just such a hassle. Like, why would you change all of that? So that was pretty much his perspective. And then I had one male friend who was like, you know, I love you and I love this for you, but don't you think you're breaking up the Black family? And I'm just like, well, that's a loaded response. The answer to his question was that me bringing kids into the world has never done anything to break the Black family. What has broken the Black family is infidelity, domestic violence, financial insecurity, economic insecurity, right? Those things, those systemic things that took 400 years to put into place. Me making this independent decision for my life is not going to fix anything, nor is it going to break something that is already considerably broken. But what it does is it offers Black women another opportunity or a different path, or women in general, to live their best lives in the context of all the things that you don't have control over, the invisible barriers. Don't let those be the things that keeps you from pursuing whatever it is you want to pursue. And for me and some in my community, it was becoming parent. One of the misconceptions of talking to a person who has made the choice to become a single parent, and in my case, as a woman, is that you arrive one day and you say, I'm going straight to the sperm bank. And that's not usually how it happens. I had a lot of good male friends in my life. And the first thing that you think is that, yes, I want to have this baby. And wouldn't it be nice to have it with someone and co-parent with someone that I respect? And so I ran into, I'd like to have a baby. I'd like to create life with you. Would you be open to that? With women who have male friends, sometimes they had wanted to be in a relationship with you. It could be hurtful to say, I'd like to have a baby with you, but not be with you. And so that was one type of side conversation. And then I had another male friend who was just like, yes, I will do it. I didn't even really ask him. I don't think he's just like, I want to do this. And then he had ideas of playing ball and, you know, the kid being in his fraternity and just had this whole life mapped out. And I'm just like, but without you. Eventually, I arrived at no more of that. You know, the sperm bank is the cleanest route legally. And at any point in time, you could say, nope, this is not for me. And so, you know, by the time you get to that point, it's your path. It's what you want.
So how would you describe your overall experience navigating the healthcare system when it came to your pregnancies and seeking fertility treatment?
Oh, I love this question. I got divorced when I was 29. I really didn't start thinking about doing anything until about 33. And so research has shown that typically women are not heard, and in particular, Black women are not heard. And so one of the things and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you today is because there are definitely points in your life when you're going to these different doctor's appointments that either the doctor could say, hey, let's test your fertility. Or you could say, hey, you know, I want to get these tests run. What I heard for most of my 20s was, oh, what form of birth control are you using? As if that was the default. You know, do we need to rewrite your prescription? Do we need to send another prescription over? So a lot of the conversations are geared toward preventing pregnancy. And I think that that's fine. You know, prevent it until you're ready, but also run the necessary tests so that a person seeking care can know their numbers as they're going through the different years and phases of their life. Like, I had fibroids, and I knew I've had fibroids since I was an adult. Never once did they say what impact a fibroid might have to me trying to conceive, right? Because the whole messaging is, don't get pregnant, you know, wait, use birth control. But no one had the conversation about, okay, so you've got these three fibroids, we're going to keep an eye on them. You're doing the assessments anyway as a doctor. There are also tests that you can run. You can just say, run a fertility panel on me, rather than just testing for, oh, is she pregnant today? Right? Run the whole fertility panel because you have my urine. You're grabbing my blood anyway. So tell me what my FSH is. Tell me what my AMH are, the levels of progesterone in my system at this particular time in my cycle. Right. So tell me more. Give me information that I can use to make informed decisions down the line. Most people don't find out that they have endometriosis until they try to get pregnant. Don't find out that they have polyovarian cystic syndrome, PCOS. Right. So that means you create a lot of eggs, but they're not high quality eggs. And then this could be why you might see bloat on your physical structure. You might have irregular periods. Some people don't ovulate. Some people don't really have a cycle. And some people might have a cycle that's a really short cycle. So that's really hard for, you know, doctors to work with and for you to get pregnant on your own. But most people don't find these things out until they try to get pregnant. The sooner you know what your fertility situation is, that means the numbers, that means the structure of your uterus. Is it, you know, intact? Do you have polyps? Do you have fibroids? Do you have cysts? Once you know all of that, then you have time to make informed decisions. Some people in their 20s find out that they have premature ovarian failure. That means that they're not producing eggs, or they're producing very few eggs. And so this determines whether you can even do IVF versus IUI. So there's a myriad of factors that go into trying to get pregnant. It's a wonder anybody gets pregnant at all. But also, if you are with a partner, there's a such thing as low sperm count, low sperm quality. And so knowing all of this ahead of time with a partner or with yourself just gives you more options down the line.
You really mentioned that. I know we talked about this in our initial conversation because it's just so difficult to even be heard in those medical spaces because it's like, I have the degree. You know, they see a lot of patients. So oftentimes you feel like you're being pushed out of the room. So they don't want to run additional tests. And it's like, you're basically fighting to have information, especially being a young woman. You get past teenagers, and obviously teenagers, you know, you shouldn't be engaging in too many things. But once you get to early adulthood, the messaging, of course, is to abstain and prevent pregnancy, which is perfectly fine. But there is the option that some people might want to have children earlier.
There are certain things in particular that Black women and other women of color encounter. Like, most people think like, oh, you go to a sperm bank, you want white sperm. And it's just like, no, I was married to a Black man. I fully envision having Black children, right? So how do you navigate the sperm bank situation when there is a limited amount of Black sperm available? And the Black sperm that is available it's a free open market. So it's not just Black women and Black families that are choosing Black sperm. Anybody can choose Black sperm. And if you look at the way people date, anybody is choosing Black sperm. They want the baby who's always tan, the curly hair. But for Black people, it's a lot deeper than that because you want a child that represents you. You want a child that looks like you, who can go into your communities, at least for my generation. I think that's changing with the generations that are coming through now, where there are a lot of interracial relationships in their own family. And so when you have a child that's biracial, multiracial, your child will fit right in. But for my generation, I don't always see that. And there still are a large number of Black women and Black families who want to use Black sperm. I wanted Black sperm, but at the time that I chose, there were 6 Black donors total. I put in my criteria because I thought I would have this list of what I wanted, and I'd sit at the computer with this list and I would get outcomes like my perfect donor. That did not happen. And that was the first realization that this might not be a smooth path. So I ended up with 2 donors to choose from, and I didn't like either one of them. So I went back out and I was like, Black is a spectrum. I live in America. We'll raise these kids in America, and America still lives by the one drop rule. So if I have children that are brown enough, they would be assumed to be Black. And so I backed out and I had dated multiculturally. And so I knew that there were certain cultures that had deeply brown people. I just needed to find those people. And so I ended up finding a dark brown, but not Black donor with tightly curled hair, because one of the things I wanted to carry over from my culture, being a Black African American woman descendant of slaves, is I wanted to be able to cornrow my daughter's hair. Mm-hmm. I wanted my children to have the Black experience, the best of the Black experience, you know, in the world, because it's not all great. But I wanted them to be able to identify with me to be able to identify with them and tell them their stories. And I did eventually get there. But, you know, there's a bit of humor here because you don't always know how the genes are going to do that math. And so you could end up, you know, every baby that's born is a surprise. And so you don't exactly know what you're going to get. And so when I had my first daughter, I was just like, oh my gosh, for the first 6 months, she was not brown. And I was just like, oh my gosh, who's this white baby? They're going to think I'm the nanny. I didn't want that to happen. She was born at the end of summer. And so it took her like to get to the next summer of being fully outside and playing in the sun for her to turn brown. And I was just like, yes. Now, I mentioned earlier that my second pregnancy was a really traumatic pregnancy, and I ended up having to use donor egg for that second pregnancy. After I started trying for my second daughter when I was 39, I ran into secondary infertility, and that meant that I was trying for two and a half years. And by the time you hit 43, most fertility clinics will stop working with a woman using her own eggs. And my only option was to use a fertility clinic. And so fertility treatments are not cheap. One of the things that I can say is if you're on the younger end and you're thinking this could be an option, but you don't know, when you start going for these different jobs and you look at the compensation packages, look at the healthcare, look at what's covered. Is egg freezing covered? Is IVF covered? Look closely at the IVF. Is it with a partner? Or can you do it as a single person? I would take a look at the prescription coverage, right? So just so that you have an understanding of what's covered, IVF can typically run from $10,000 to upwards of $30,000, depending on your situation and where you're located. There are definitely clinics that are cheaper, but just to have a ballpark idea, $10,000 to $30,000. I was fortunate enough with my first pregnancy to do it using IUI, which is intrauterine insemination. And it's just pretty much, this is the time of the month you can get pregnant. Let's throw some sperm up there and let's cross our fingers. And I got pregnant on the second try. IUI will range between $200 to $300 if you're using a midwife, or $2,000 to $2,500 if you're using a fertility clinic, which is considerably less than $10,000 to $30,000. And so most people will start with an IUI. When I ran into secondary infertility with my second child, I had done multiple rounds of IVF, probably two or three rounds, and I had run out of money. And I really wanted this baby. And so when I said, if you decide you want to be a parent, there are a number of ways that you can become a parent. You can carry a pregnancy, you can do surrogacy, you can adopt, you can use your own egg, you can use donor egg. And I opted to use donor egg because I was running out of money and was running out of time, and I was ready to be done. And so my last try with my daughter was the last. I had no more embryos, I had no more money, I was done. And she's here to be bear witness to that story.
Now that you're, you know, with a 4-year-old and an almost 9-year-old, how would you describe that experience looking back at it and now having them both here and parenting?
It's amazing. To be honest, our life is simple. I streamlined it so that it could work for me. There's a lot of time while you're trying to conceive that is downtime, where you're waiting to get to a procedure, you're waiting to get the green light to start. And I really used that time to really think about what I wanted my life to look like. And for me, community was a big, big part of that life. And so, you know, my daycare, my before and after care for my daughter who's in school is all in a community-based location. We've seen the same people, the same families for 5 years. They've seen me pregnant. They love my girls. We talk. They are a part of a community that has diversity, and not just racial diversity, but socioeconomic diversity, that they have avenues and opportunities to build character. They can be the giver and they can also be the receiver. And so that is something that I have interwoven into our lives. They are learning that even at 4 and 9, they have choices to make in this world. So yeah, so now when I look at my life and I'm on the other side, I just feel so grateful and so happy that this opportunity was available to me and that I was brave enough and had the courage to snatch it. Every day, you know, aside from whatever is going on, I feel like I have snatched happiness out of the universe and I'm holding on to it for dear life. And it is such a peaceful feeling. People say that, oh, kids need a two-parent household. Kids don't necessarily need a two-parent household. They need an adult and they need people who love them and they need peace and they need consistency and stability, right? So my kids come home, you know, it's quiet, it's peaceful. And I will fight tooth and nail to protect their peace because then they get to be thoughtful. They get to think about how they want to be in the world. rather than being reactive to the terrible things that can happen to kids and, you know, generational trauma. My podcast and the various platforms to be able to turn around and give that back to somebody and have those 3 years of trying, kind of like going through a college level course on fertility, infertility, and secondary infertility, but just being able to turn that around to be something that is good and beneficial in the world has been a gift that I feel like I've given myself. And I still fight for being able to give that gift to someone else.
It's so nice to hear you speak about motherhood in such a positive way and then pursuing that, you know, life of being a single mother by choice. There's always this negative connotation with single motherhood, particularly whether it's by choice or whether it's not. And it's like, even in my own experience, I never grew up feeling like I was missing anything. You can still be whole. You're not necessarily missing out on opportunities that other people have just, you know, by default. And I like that you emphasize that.
It takes a village. And there are men in that village too, you know, and they may not be romantic partners, but they're just really good people. And I think that it's important, whether it's men, women, whomever you bring into your life, the people who typically love you are going to love your kid, and they're going to pour into your kids, and they're going to offer your kids experiences that you probably can't offer them, don't have the time, or just like take them. But it really, really does. I can't stress this enough to find a village, because while you can do it yourself, you can do it alone, but life is so much richer when you have people and friends to do it with. Like my kids, they go to school, you know, it's probably a 50-50 split of traditional and non-traditional families. But when we get together and we do summer vacations, you know, they're summering with other single mother by choice kids. And what it is that you're doing is, yes, you're socializing, but you're also building them a safe space in a community of trusted peers, because they're probably at some point are going to say, hey, so-and-so said I don't have a dad, you know, that made me feel some kind of way. And them being able to have that comfort and support with their own peer group, because there's a point in time where they don't want to talk to mom, because mom's always going to say, I wanted you. You're here because you're loved. And, you know, all the rosy things that parents, you know, we love our kids. Sometimes they want the very real from a peer. Like, how did you handle this? What words did you use? And I think you build it when they're young, right? And so it still takes a village to raise a child. I just conceived on my own.
I like that you note that as well. We're coming to the end of the episode, but I want to circle back to something that you said earlier. So you discussed your experience, of course, being married or just in a long-term relationship from a young age. And of course, this is a space that a lot of us find ourselves in where, you know, you're with a partner and you've devoted all this time. You've been together for a long period of time, especially when you're young, and you just aren't really meeting eye to eye on what you want your futures to look like. So what advice would you maybe give people, and it doesn't just have to be women, in this position where there are certain things they want, whether it be a child, whether it just be a career, but their relationship is not necessarily allowing them to do so?
I will say you want to listen, like actively listen. Communication is going to be so important, and choose kindness, right? Because at the end of the day, this is still someone you either loved, respected, or loved and respect. Right. And so you don't want to lose the friendship or the relationship if you don't have to, but be honest and assertive. Right. And I think you have to know who you are. So if you're not seeing eye to eye, feel free to pause. And so I have practiced pausing in the moment when something is happening. And I will typically use words like, huh, that's interesting. Right. And that's in the moment where things can go left. But also, if you're having, like, you know, you've got all the time in the world and you're having a conversation, you can pause. Let's take a break and let's regroup. Let's talk about this next week. Let's pause and let the dust settle. Surround yourself with people who support you and the relationship. I think that that's where my marriage really hit the skids, is that I had people who supported me. They're like, go, girl, get that ring. But we didn't have people who supported the relationship. And then pay attention to red flags. Red flags are not these physical things that wave in our face. It's what happens to your belly when you're having certain conversations, right? What stays with you after that conversation is ended? What's rolling around in your head? Like, that didn't feel right. Something about that didn't feel right. Sit with that for a minute and be able to either jot it down. What didn't feel right? But honor your intuition and what feels right to you, because from the day that we are born. And as women, we're told to ignore that, right? But messaging for a lot of women and a lot of young people are ignore that, right? But don't ignore it, because if the relationship is that important to you, have the conversation, have the hard conversations. Chances are, you know, things will be fine. But if they're not, you have left a person whole. So in every situation, I try to leave people whole, whether or not we're going to be together, whether or not we're going to remain friends. There are things that we can say that are so hurtful. Just leave them unsaid. Leave that person whole. When I ran into the skids with my ex-husband, there were things that were said that were being done that I'm just like, I could stay in this and I can watch you become a hollow shell of who you are. You deserve to have what you want. I'm standing in the way of that because I'm never going to be that thing, that person you want me to be. So I need to leave you whole and then walk away. Now, when you walk away, you make sure you walk to a therapist, right? Because you still want to unpack that stuff that was unsaid. And you still want to say it in a safe space that's not going to come back to bite you, you know, and don't carry it around with you.
Yeah, I really love that you say leave people whole. When you said that, I even thought of the fact that instead of trying to change somebody or change aspects of their life, just leave them as they are. Okay, no, this person doesn't support my dreams or have the same ideals that I have, but I should be flexible. Maybe I should pass up that job or pass up that opportunity to be more inclusive of the relationship. And I like that you said it's okay to leave people whole. So, you know, we don't have to say all this. I don't have to try and change you. You know, you're how you are. I am how I am. And maybe that's just not compatible. Even though you've already left us with a lot of gems, but if you have, you know, a quote or thought, and then also if you have any upcoming work or, you know, recommendations that you'd like to note as well for the last point of the episode.
Well, I will say this, my podcast, Start to Finish Motherhood, is in season one. We're on hiatus because kids and summer is a thing. We'll be coming back in the fall with fresh new episodes. So be sure to tune in, follow the podcast. The thought that I would like to leave people with is that everyone has a story. My story started out kind of rocky. I lost both parents by the time I was 13. I navigate the world with knowing that everything that I am and everything that I have is my safety net. No one's going to come save me. And so that's how I navigate the world. But also, having lost parents at such an early age, they were young and I was young. And looking back is that I don't want to get to my deathbed and have regrets. And so I treat people with kindness, and ultimately I make the decisions that I think are best for me having the extraordinary life that I'm meant to have. I don't think that God put me on this earth to hide my gift under a bushel. Any people who are going to come into my life are going to be people that are going to love, honor, and support me, and they get to stay. But choose to live a life of no regrets.
I really like that, to be honest. If people are not aligning with your goals, they're not supporting you, we obviously do not make decisions to please other people so they can go. I like that a lot. And I'll be including links to your information, especially your podcast. I listen to it as well. It's a great listen. So I'll be including that in the episode notes so that everybody can go and check it out as well, and then be on the lookout when season two comes along. Once again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being a guest, and thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing your story.
And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for constantly listening and supporting the podcast. You know, although I appreciate the support thus far, I will say that I always appreciate when you go ahead to whatever platform you're listening, whether it be Apple Music, Spotify, etc., to leave a review as well as follow the podcast. It's super helpful to leave a review so that everyone else knows that this is a podcast that is worth listening to. And when you listen to an episode and it kind of resonates with you and you feel like there are key messages that you took from it, why not share it? Why not post it on your social media? Why not send it to your bestie, your man, whoever, because you benefited from the information, you found it helpful. So of course, there has to be someone in your contact list who you think would resonate with the information as well. Because if you don't, then that is kind of gatekeeping if you think about it, because we got to put our friends on. You can find my link tree in the podcast episode notes. As always, you know, I love when you listen to an episode and then instead of just going and making yourself some food or just turning off your laptop, you head straight to the podcast Instagram and let me know your feedback when it's fresh on the brain. Of course, I do this for me, but I also do this for listeners. So it's great to hear what the listeners think so that I can also cater future episodes to what you guys think as well. Go and check Aisha's podcast out. You'll find all her details and links where you can find her information in the episode notes. Until next time, sincerely, Jada.